Being pregnant and giving birth with type 1 diabetes takes specific intention, energy, and management of health. And on the podcast today, I have Dr. Gina Cummins on to tell us how she has managed her blood sugar throughout her two pregnancies and home births. We discuss how the conventional route of prenatal care and birth for women with type 1 diabetes is different from those who don't have it, including the risk factors and reasoning for why it is this way. And then Dr. Gina goes on to explain how she has advocated for herself to walk an alternative path outside the system. She found a supportive midwife and had both babies at home. And as she shares her birth stories, you'll see that she weaves in how she was actively managing her insulin in between contractions. Blood sugar management is a full-time job, and I hope you find this episode as educational as it is impressive. Let's go.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Growing a baby, healing postpartum, making milk, your body's mineral needs are off the chart during these times. And that's why Dr. Leah and I swear by Relight by Redmond, the real salt people, an electrolyte powder packed with USA mined unrefined sea salt and essential minerals like magnesium, calcium, and potassium. Unlike many popular electrolyte companies, Redmond is the only company who is completely transparent about their sodium source because they own and operate the mine. It's clean, delicious, and the perfect thing for labor, breastfeeding, and thriving in mom life. So go ahead and grab a sample pack to try all of the flavors or hand your trust over to me and start with strawberry lemonade. Go to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 15% off. Hydration handled. Okay, so welcome to the show. Today we have Dr. Gina Cummins, ND, naturopathic doctor. So Dr. Gina and I went to school together at Bastyr in San Diego. And we have remained really close friends ever since. Actually, I feel like we're closer now after school than we were during school, which is kind of a bummer because I feel like we could have enjoyed our friendship longer during school. But I don't know. It just like didn't happen until after we've graduated. And now I feel like we're sort of like family. We come and we visit you every week. We stay in your home or you guys come to us sometimes. And it's just like such a sweet little relationship. But anyway, the reason why we're having you on the podcast today, I like to give some background in case people care or not to know, is that you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and you're going to tell us your story of when and how old you were and everything. And you've had two healthy, beautiful pregnancies and home births, which are things that somebody with type 1 diabetes is sometimes told that they cannot do. And so the reason why I want to have you on today is to make this episode sort of a resource of the story and the resource the inspiration for somebody who's maybe wanting to go a little bit off the beaten path and be an information source for people who don't really understand like what it is about diabetes that would maybe make pregnancy more complicated or birth more complicated. And I think that your story is really unique because of the way that you manage it in the moment. And it's just like so fascinating to hear about. So can you please introduce yourself to us, Dr. Gina, and also tell us your diabetes story?
Yes. Hi. So I'm a naturopathic doctor and I've had type 1 diabetes for 22 years. I was diagnosed a couple weeks before I turned 13. And I didn't always take the best care of myself in the very beginning. It was just a hard age. I was a teenager and I didn't really have a lot of the tools. As soon as I found what I wanted to do in life, which was natural medicine, I just took my health into my own hands and changed my life pretty dramatically. And yeah, the rest is history. I'm a naturopathic doctor now, and I love helping and seeing type 1 diabetics. And I've had two amazing pregnancies. I love being pregnant, and managing diabetes when you're pregnant can be tricky, but it's so worth it. And I had the best care of my diabetes ever while I was pregnant. And I had two babies born at home without medical intervention, and it was glorious. So that's just my brief background and history as to why I'm here today.
Yeah, thank you. I think that it's really inspiring the way, and we'll get into the birth stories a little bit too of what I heard, at least, you know, I wasn't there obviously, but what your husband told my husband and how you were managing,
your blood sugar in the moment, like between contractions. And that's something that I think that people don't realize. I didn't actually realize until becoming friends with you, how many, you know, decisions that you have to make as a type 1 diabetic all throughout the day of looking at your numbers and making these choices with your insulin pump and, like, you know, being at your house and like the different beeps and kind of like warning alarms and stuff that you guys have set up, which is so brilliant and smart, but it's just, it's so very integrated in your life. And someone who doesn't have that, like me, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is, I mean, you never, ever get a break from this or you would die. And I know that sounds really morbid, but you and I have talked about that fact. So it's like something that people just don't realize how full on it is. And my dad and my half-brother also have type 1 diabetes, but I don't know. It just like didn't, maybe because they managed it a little bit differently, or I didn't see it as much growing up, but even just spending the couple of weeks every year that I do with you, I'm like, wow, this is a whole thing. Like, and now in pregnancy, the reason why this can be even trickier is because for a normal physiology, insulin can, you know, 15-fold increase and your body is building an entire new baby. There's so many different changes going on to the body, and blood sugar can just yo-yo up and down. So I'd love for you to tell us, you know, what are the concerns for somebody with diabetes being pregnant, and how is it different? And like, what are you needing to be doing that somebody who doesn't have type 1 diabetes, like, what are they like not even aware of that they don't have to do, you know?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so I will try to answer this as best as I can. Cause there's a lot in there, but,
yes.
Okay. So like, where to start? Let me just say that, let me preface this by, all of the risks associated with type 1 diabetes and pregnancy are all based on studies that were done in the 70s and the 80s. And there's a commonly referenced study that was done in 1949. So this is all like pre-continuous glucose monitor, pre-pump. Some of them were pre-finger pricks, pre-A1C. So all this modern ways to manage and treat diabetes, like, it was all before that. So these things are life-changing for people with diabetes and completely has changed the way that we manage our disease. So it's unfortunate that we still use these foundational studies as like the basis for how to treat someone with type 1 diabetes in pregnancy. However, they do show the things that can occur if you don't take good care of yourself when you have diabetes. And in those studies, a lot of the women had A1Cs in the 9s, the 10s, and over that. And so those are like estimated average glucoses of, you know, 250 and higher. So if your blood sugar is out of the normal, which is 80 to 150, and actually that standard range is going to be even lower when you're pregnant, you want it to be 65 to 140. So I don't know, this is getting a little crazy here, but those risks are virtually the same as a normal person, a normal pregnant person, if you take really good care of yourself and your A1C is below 6. So just something to consider when someone with diabetes is thinking about getting pregnant and they're Googling and they're seeing all these risks, or maybe their doctor is telling them all these things. It's like, if you're taking really good care of yourself, I don't think, in my opinion, you have much to worry about. So, but the risks associated with type 1 diabetes and pregnancy, they're for the fetus and then for the maternal risks. So I'll just go through those. So in the fetus, there's an increased risk of miscarriage, and that's just associated with poor glycemic control and congenital malformations, mostly of the spine and the and cardiac system. Again, those are usually associated with uncontrolled diabetes. And then you have macrosomia, which, because the mom has a higher glucose going on in her body and glucose crosses the placenta, the baby is constantly producing a higher than normal insulin levels. And because of that, they're getting bigger and bigger. So I had normal size babies, none of them were macrosomic. And, you know, gestational diabetes, I think those women you tend to see macrosomic babies with those patients. But you know, small women can have huge babies. And I think to be a macrosomic baby, it's like 8 pounds and 13 ounces. I mean, I have friends that have like 9 and 10 pound babies. So I don't know. It's a little interesting. And then with a bigger than normal baby, there is an increased risk for birth trauma. So shoulder dystocia for sure. I think the huge one that most type 1 diabetic women fear is that risk of stillbirth, because it is a little bit higher in a type 1 diabetic pregnancy than a normal pregnancy. And again, that's just associated with really poor control, and the risk increases so greatly if you go into an emergency situation called diabetic ketoacidosis in the third trimester. It could just be really scary. And then another thing is the neonatal hypoglycemia, which we just talked about a little bit. So that's a low blood sugar in the baby once they're born. And we'll talk about that a little bit later as well. And then the risks to the mom include just blood sugar irregularities. So in the first trimester, you're actually more prone to getting lower blood sugars, so hypoglycemia. And then in the second and third trimesters, we're just seeing a lot of hyperglycemia risk for that. You have so many hormones that are being produced by the ovaries and the adrenal glands and the placenta that are just causing so much insulin resistance that you're doubling and tripling your pre-pregnancy amounts of insulin. And it can just be really, really intense. And then the risk for preeclampsia increases with type 1 diabetes. And that's mostly due to just like vascular involvement. And in a mom who has longstanding diabetes, you could have these complications from having diabetes for a really long time. And these complications are with your eyes and with your kidney and with your heart. So pre-existing hypertension, and those things can actually just worsen because pregnancy as a whole just increases these metabolic demands. And that just causes it can cause a lot of issues with these microvascular rich organs that we have. And then you have the increased risk of C-section because they don't often let you go past 37 or 38 weeks in the conventional way of treatment of type 1 diabetes. So if you have a big baby, they're also going to urge you to get a C-section as well. And I would say C-section is super common in the conventional way of treating a type 1 diabetic who's pregnant.
Yeah, because they're probably going to induce first, and induction at 37 weeks is less likely to become successful because that's, you know, 3 weeks before average baby would be ready to come, potentially even 5 weeks before if we're going to like 42. So that's just a body and a baby that's potentially not going to be ripened and primed for induction. It's one of my favorite things to like myth bust is that just because you go and you have a plan to be induced, it does not mean that it's going to work. Inductions can fail. And what that means is that like your body doesn't respond. You don't dilate. There, you know, maybe the baby's heart rate is not handling Pitocin very well or whatever. And so then after this process has begun and it's been started, and if now we're not progressing or things are getting a little harrowing or scary, C-section is the only way out of that. And so when we sign up for inductions, we have to understand that there's a very good chance of a C-section happening. And I feel like there's so much misinformation around that, that people are like, there's no more increased risk of cesarean when we induce. And it has to go back to the ARRIVE trial, which was like debunked as being anything helpful, although ACOG and all of the like organizations really cherry picked their data and they made all these different recommendations that were affecting women negatively for like a very long time. And now I think we're coming on the other side of the ARRIVE trial and seeing that actually it wasn't all that relevant because of the way that the study was done. But anyways, I just wanted to say that about induction, that it's not that helpful. And then yes, so macrosomia, I'm so glad you mentioned these points about it, because a big baby is really difficult to diagnose. The way that they're going to do it is with ultrasound. And we also know very clearly in the evidence that ultrasounds for weight estimates in babies in the third trimester are notoriously wrong, upwards of 2 pounds plus or minus off on the baby's weight. So let's just say that the baby actually is 7 pounds. It could say on the ultrasound the baby's 9 pounds, or it could say on the ultrasound that the baby is 5 pounds. Okay. And it's like, that's a huge deal. So, I mean, how many times have you or I, because we've been in this birth world and we're both like obsessed with being moms and babies. Like, I love being a mom with you. It's so much fun because I feel like we have the same philosophy on just being like totally obsessed with the process. But is like, how many times have we heard it where people are like, yeah, my baby's measuring like 11 pounds. So I have to go have a cesarean. And it's like, wow, that sounds really scary. And then they go and then the baby's 8 pounds or something. I'm actually really glad that nobody told me how big my first baby would have been, was. He was 9 pounds, 3 ounces. The midwife was like palpating my belly and she said he was going to be probably 7 pounds. My husband and I were both 7 pounds. I did not have gestational diabetes. I had always low blood sugar. I don't know why I made such a big baby. Like, I don't know. But either way, I'm really glad that didn't get in my head because when things got super hard in that first labor, it's not helpful to know these things, to hear these things. I do understand where the risk mitigation is coming from in situations where, yeah, sometimes when women have very uncontrolled blood sugar the entire time, you have to imagine there's high levels of glucose in the bloodstream constantly. And so where is that glucose going to go? It builds to fat and it grows an overall very large baby. And sometimes, yeah, they're gigantic and they do need to come out in a different way, or they would get stuck and they'd have a very difficult or scary shoulder dystocia. And shoulder dystocia is not just something that is like, oh yeah, they got stuck and then we got them out. It's like, no, you can actually, babies can have their collarbones broken. They can have a brachial plexus injury at the shoulder where then their arm is totally rendered useless for the rest of their life. Like whichever side of that arm was, they can potentially have even further complication like cerebral palsy or death from lack of oxygen. So it is a big thing. I'm not trying to discount that. I'm just saying that both and are true. That yes, macrosomia can be an issue. And just because somebody has gestational diabetes or type 1 diabetes in pregnancy does not mean that their baby's going to be big. And our weight estimate method right now is really highly inaccurate. So it's difficult for physicians, midwives, and patients to make these decisions because it's like, what do we do? You know? So anyway, I just had to go off on a couple of tangents there. Thank you for outlining all of those risks. And also while you were talking, it made me think of this two-part episode series that we have with Lily Nichols, who specifically is talking about gestational diabetes. So I will link those in the show notes too, to make this like a little triplet, diabetes and pregnancy of all forms, like a little package in the show notes so that you guys can learn more if this is affecting you in your life or somebody that you know and you can share it with them, because I think it's really interesting and could be really helpful. There's a lot of overlap, of course, but one thing that you said I want you to tell us about your experience with is that in the second and third trimester, the insulin resistance can be so great that you're having to take. So one thing that, and just in case anybody doesn't know, maybe we should have said this in the beginning, type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition that attacks the pancreas, specific cells in the pancreas called islet cells. And now you cannot make insulin. Insulin is what's needed to bring the glucose into the cells away from the bloodstream. So type 1 diabetics have to take insulin. Sometimes type 2 diabetics don't have to take insulin. Sometimes if it's very severe, then they do. Sometimes with gestational diabetes, they don't have to, most of the time actually, they don't have to take insulin, but sometimes they do if it's very severe. So just because we hear the word diabetes, you have to kind of figure out, well, what type is it? What's exactly going on? But for sure, if you hear type 1 diabetes, though, for sure that person is on insulin. They have to be on insulin for the rest of their life. They will never not be able to be on insulin. And it's like a very important, you know, this is one of those medical inventions that has saved so many lives because you wouldn't be able to live without it, right? And so you now have had two pregnancies where you've had to, on top of your just daily management of your insulin based on what you eat and your activity level, you're having this fluctuation and this change happening in the second and third trimester where you're having to take, what did you say, like 4 times the amount?
Yes. Yeah, so I'll provide an example too, but let's just say before I get pregnant or I would get pregnant, I would take 20, 30 units of insulin total a day. Then in that first trimester, maybe it's 25, so a little less, or maybe 35, just a little bit more. In that second trimester, I can go up to like 60, 70. And in that third trimester, I can get up to 150 or 200 units a day.
Oh my gosh. Yes. And how do you – so you're just watching your because you have, what's the device thing that you have? Sorry.
Yes, I use an insulin pump, but sometimes I'll do multiple daily injections to just give my body a break, but that's a whole nother topic. So anyways, with the insulin pump, I'm constantly changing the settings depending on where I'm at in pregnancy. And so I could be making tweaks every day, every 3 days, every week. I would say more intensely starting around week like 27, 28 is when you really start to peak the insulin resistance. And then it actually gets a little bit better around like weeks 37 and 38. You see a little bit of less insulin resistance. But I mean, yes, we're just getting a crazy amount of insulin resistance and so much insulin to cover that. And you're just, you know, you're so concerned. You don't want to hurt your baby or harm it or cause any kind of risks, you know, to happen. So you're just like, you become obsessed. I feel like every type 1 diabetic that I've talked to has the best care they've ever had in their life when they're pregnant. And they just become obsessed with their blood sugar and making sure that it's perfect all the time. So me, let's say, okay, it's stone fruit season usually when I am pregnant and I'm in my second or third trimester, and I just love peaches so much. So pre-pregnancy, I can dose, let's say, 3 units for a peach. If I'm in my late second or third trimester, I'm dosing like anywhere from like 7 to 9 units for the same size peach. So that's just a good example that I like to use, because your body just changes so much. You have so many hormones. You have cortisol, you have progesterone and estrogen, you have this crazy hormone, human placental lactogen, which is like the main cause of insulin resistance. What other hormones? Growth hormone. There's a growth hormone from the placenta that takes over. And there's just all these things that are just heightening this insulin resistance and causing it. And in a normal non-diabetic pregnancy, you actually go into an insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is a normal adaptive part of pregnancy because you're trying to feed the baby. You want the baby to grow. And so it's actually a brilliant little thing that your body does. It increases your blood sugar. But in a normal person, you have insulin that you can produce. And in gestational, sometimes you can't produce enough insulin to cover the rise that is happening naturally. And that's why gestational can happen. And in a type 1 diabetic, it's just so much harder because we're not producing our own insulin. So we're just increasing the exogenous insulin that we have to take. So it's, anyways, like it can change by day how much, like little tweaks that you do. And it takes a lot of work and you have to be comfortable with it. And I have lived with type 1 diabetes for a long time. And obviously I'm a doctor, so it helps to have all this. But I have friends that are type 1 diabetic and have had natural births. And it's possible for anyone, I think. But it takes a lot of work. There's also, I would love to shout out this Facebook group called, I think it's Natural Birth for Type 1 Diabetics. And it's on Facebook. It's amazing. You can go, you can post your story, you can ask any questions, and you have hundreds of type 1 diabetic women who have achieved healthy, normal, unmedicated, or maybe just vaginal births, and everyone's rooting for each other there, and it's a great little community. So if you're listening to this and you feel alone, or maybe you live in a different country and you feel alone, just know that there are little resources and community of women that would love to help you.
I wrote that down in the show notes too, so we'll link that and make it easy for anybody to find it. Question for you, did you ever have the experience, or is this not possible, where when you're giving yourself so much more insulin that you maybe have a moment where there's less insulin resistance, or I don't know, something, and then you go too low, like you have a hypoglycemic event in that second, third trimester, or is that like not a thing?
Yeah, I've definitely gone low in the third trimester from just like taking too much insulin, but the fight to not be high is so much more intense than the fight to not be go low. So when you go low, okay, you can just treat it quickly, right? With some, like a glucose gel or a glucose tab or some juice or whatever. There's sugar literally everywhere. So you just eat that, right? And you could just treat it. But if your blood sugar is high and you're super insulin resistant, like it's going to take a lot to get it down. So that is more of a fight to me than a low blood sugar. I'm not super concerned about having low blood sugars for me or for the baby. I mean, I'm not going to advocate for a woman to have low blood sugars. Like it's not good for you and it's not good probably for the baby, but a low blood sugar isn't going to hurt the baby because you're always going to give the baby what it needs first. Like the baby's going to take whatever it needs and pull from your body first. So that's not something I'm very concerned about.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And it takes, there's a time delay, right? Like you give yourself insulin and you're waiting to see the numbers fall and then waiting and then maybe give a little more. You know, it's just this, it's very time consuming. It's micromanagement on such a hyperdrive level. And so I just want to give a lot of props to you for all of the work that you do with this, because I know that it was really important to you for, to be able to have home births. And so that level of management had to be just that much better to find a provider that would work with you. So speaking of that, how was it difficult for you to find somebody who would take you on as a midwife, given the restrictions? Like usually type 1 diabetes is something that people don't, they'll say, no, you cannot have a home birth. And it depends on your state, of course, too. But like, how was that process for you? Was it okay? Was it difficult, et cetera?
Okay. So yeah, I'll talk a little bit about my journey here. I would say that I always, not always, but I dreamed of having a home birth. But in my mind, I was like, oh, I'm type 1 diabetic. Like I can't do that. There's no way I could do that. And I, when Curtis or my husband and I were trying to think of, or we were thinking about getting pregnant, I bought some books that had to do with type 1 diabetes and pregnancy. And I, in one of the books, a woman had had a really bad first birth experience in the conventional setting. There was just a lot of interventions that happened that she didn't want. She got the cesarean and it was just the whole cascade of interventions that can happen anyways. And, she was like, I want to do it differently for my second. I want to do a home birth. And anyways, I read this and I was freaking out because I was like, wow, there is someone that has done this. And then I was like, I had already, so I got pregnant. I went to a normal OB and just kind of feel them out, you know, didn't know if that was going to be the person I was going to use. And, it just wasn't, it wasn't like a great feeling. I didn't walk out of there being like, yes, I'm pregnant. I cannot wait to see this pregnancy through this office and have like birth with these people in the hospital. It was just ugh, like gross. Like I'm a naturopathic doctor. Like that setting doesn't feel homey to me. So what I decided to do was reach out to midwives in my area. And I just did that. I sent a bunch of emails to a lot of local midwives, and they all came back saying, no, 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 no. Except Lindsay Mielis, she was my midwife for both my babies. And she said, yeah, like, come on in, like, let's have a meeting. So I went, I met with her, and she was saying, because this was my first, and she would feel more comfortable if we had Dr. Stu on board as well, just to cover her license. And Dr. Stu is an amazing obstetrician. Who don't know Dr. Stu, look him up. He's great. Anyways, I met with him as well, and he told me that he had just recently done a home birth for a type 1 diabetic in Los Angeles and asked if I wanted to talk to her. And I was like, yes, link me, please. That would be amazing. So I actually got the opportunity to talk with her on the phone, and it was her fourth kid. So it was, you know, she had already been through this three times. And, but, you know, it was just so nice to hear that she had achieved a home birth as a type 1 diabetic. She told me some things to look out for. And anyways, so that just made it more like, okay, I'm going to do this. We're doing this. Curtis was, my husband was on board. You have pumped me up forever to do home birth. So I just had a good, I would say, support group around me that were just mostly Curtis, my husband, and my birth team, and a couple of my friends. Because my mom always told me that I have a tipped uterus. She had a tipped uterus. Her mom had a tipped uterus. They all had, my whole family is cesarean. So I was likely going to have to be born cesarean because that's just how it is in our family. And so I kind of just wanted to prove to her that that's not true. Like, there's, you know, that's not true. That doesn't have to be true. Just because you have a tipped uterus doesn't mean that you have to have a cesarean. So I feel like I'm getting off course here, but...
No, this is great. I think that it's so important that you mention that because a lot of women carry the stories of their maternal line and the way that they were born and the way that all the other women birthed in their family to heart. And there is maybe the only thing I can think of that where that would actually play out is if there was some sort of like higher likelihood of a genetically inherited, differently shaped uterus. Like tipped is one thing. That's like whatever. That doesn't matter. But there are actually uteri. I don't know if that's what we call it.
I said that the other day, actually.
Yeah, I think it might be.
Like antennae, but uteri, yeah.
Octopi. I think that where it's like it has a septum or if it's heart-shaped or something like something odd like that, a bicornate uterus, sometimes those can run in families. But I really implore every woman who is dealing with that as a deep internal fear that the way that they were born and all the other women were born is going to influence their birth story to look into a particular type of birth class that's called birthing from within. I'll put that in the show notes. I also have Dr. Stu and Lindsay's information in the show notes because both of them are amazing follows on Instagram, and Dr. Stu has a great podcast as well. So as an OBGYN, he can kind of like help, I don't want to say like break the rules. That's not what I'm saying, but he has the authority legally to oversee births from midwives who are wanting to support patients that want to do breech and twins and different things like that at home because he is an OBGYN, which is something OBGYNs can do under their licenses, but not midwives. So sometimes midwives will work with an OB who's overseeing the care and helping them with all the things in these situations where like usually it would be just a refer out or a no, like all those other midwives said no to you. But in this situation, this like little dream team said, yeah, let's do it. And it just goes to show that there is so much outside of the law. Like I understand why there are laws. There should be some laws and it should be the woman's choice of how she wants to go about doing this, understanding the risks and then taking those forward and not just saying like, nope, you can't. It's like, well, why? Like, what do you mean? Anyway, so birthing from within, though, is a particular type of birth preparation class and philosophy. You know, it's like almost saying it's an alternative to hypnobirthing or to like Lamaze and the Bradley method and all that. But birthing from within specifically uses some different like art, multimedia, journaling, meditation stuff to really uproot if a woman has any sort of deeply set fears around birth. And one of them is about this like maternal lineage story too. So just if that resonates with anybody, there's a book, there's classes, etc. So I'll put that in the show notes. And now a word from our sponsor. As we're talking about birth and postpartum support, I want to share my favorite reproductive health nutrition brand, Needed. Pregnancy and postpartum are the most nutritionally demanding phases of a woman's life. Many women will stop their prenatal after birth, but we actually recommend continuing it for at least the first 9 months postpartum and longer if you're breastfeeding. Needed's prenatal multivitamin is the most robust formula I've ever seen, and it contains the bioavailable nutrients you need in evidence-based dosages, which are well above the bare minimums that most prenatals settle for. Their quality standards are also top tier, with transparent sourcing and rigorous third-party testing. And that is why now over 6,000 practitioners recommend Needed. Now, also, we have the results from their IRB-approved clinical study, which confirms what we see clinically, that women who take the Needed prenatal multi had significantly higher blood levels of nutrients critical for postpartum and beyond, including vitamin D, B6, B12, riboflavin, K2, and selenium. Only women in the Needed group reached the sufficient levels of vitamin D, which plays a big role in immune health, energy, and mood regulation, all so important during the postpartum season. So while there are many ways to support yourself postpartum, continuing your prenatal is one of the simplest, most impactful ways to do it, and Needed makes it easy. So learn more at thisisneeded.com/thrive to see more about this study, and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 20% off of your first order. Yes, healthy mother, as a little mantra or affirmation for yourself. It's so cool. Okay, now back to the show. Can you go ahead and tell us about your birth stories?
Sure, yeah, we'd love to. Okay, so my first one is a I was just seeing my kid go to for a swim lesson in the pool, but okay, so Carmen, my firstborn, it was a pretty typical, like, long 18 hours birth, and I was tired, I was exhausted, but like, you're always told what to expect, but you don't know what to expect until, you know, you're in it and you're actually, like, able to feel what's going on, and you kind of don't want to be doing it anymore is kind of my vibe that first time. I was like, this is way too crazy. I actually don't want to be doing this. Someone please save me. So those are all really normal things to happen during a birth, especially if you haven't done it before. But no one was taking me to the hospital because we had already had this game plan of like, hey, if I say this, like, don't listen to me. Just, you know. But like, listen to me if you like are really scared. You know what I mean? But anyways, okay. So pretty typical birth story. It was 18 hours. It was long. It was grueling. Ew, because I was laboring during the day, and like, the sun came up and I didn't have my baby till nearly like 3 or 4 p.m. and there were people here. I didn't want to be looked at. The sun was shining, like, ugh. I definitely became full mammal. I like hid in a dark closet and I labored by myself for hours, and I didn't want anyone to be around me. I was like, go away. Go away. Like, I'm doing my thing. Anyways, when it started to get really, really intense, I was like, hey, I'm tired. I actually just want to lay down on my bed and have this baby. And so that's what I did. Had my first on my bed, and it was, yeah, it was crazy hard. But like, as soon as I birthed her, I was like, can we do this again?
Okay, one thing I remember from your first birth is that you said that you had this moment where you were like on the floor in your shower with like the water coming over your head.
Yes.
Alone, thinking to yourself, how am I going to tell Curtis that I'm never doing this again, that we're never having any more
children? Yeah, I was like, oh my gosh, like, we're only going to have one child. Like, one child. This is it. This is all I'm doing ever again. We're done. But yeah, as soon as I gave birth and I was done, I was like, okay, I could do this again for sure. Like, it's like an addicting thing. Like, birthing a baby and like seeing your own beautiful baby, there's just nothing like it. And yeah, I want to do it like five more times.
I know. It's the wildest thing to feel such opposing things at the same time of, I can't. Oh my God, I want to immediately again. It makes you feel crazy, honestly.
Yeah. Like a drug addict. Like, you know, it's like, ugh. Anyways, okay. So I should talk about how this relates to diabetes, in that Dr. Stu had told me, he's like, Gina, your blood sugar is going to go high during your labor process. This is what I've seen in my experience. So I need you to be ready for that and, you know, dose accordingly. And in my mind, and from a couple books that I've read, those women had low blood sugar during labor because it's a lot of work. It's a lot. Like, your muscles are using a lot of glucose. Like, there's a lot going on there. But cortisol won this battle, and I turned my insulin pump off. And so I wasn't getting any insulin when I started like actively pushing. And sure enough, my blood sugar shot up. It shot up to the mid 200s, and it was a really stubborn high. So let me just, you don't want to have high blood sugars in your late trimester when you're getting really close to delivery, because it's going to increase your the baby's risk for having a dangerous low. So neonatal hypoglycemia. This is why they urge you not to have a high blood sugar super close to birth. So anyways, I shot up, and I kept injecting during contractions, trying to get it down, and it just wasn't budging. I think I got it down a little bit right before she was born. And anyways, we took her blood sugar, I would say like within 30 minutes after she was born, and she had a great normal blood sugar. It was like in the 80s or 90s, which is great. And yeah, then we just monitored her blood sugar, you know, every couple of hours or so for like 48 hours. But after the 48 hours, I never tested her blood sugar again. Like it totally normalized and I wasn't tripping about it at all. And that happens in most type 1 diabetic pregnancies. I feel like the baby isn't low, and maybe they do experience some lows after birth, but it's super common. I mean, it's super common for the baby to be born with a blood sugar of 25, 45, 50. As long as they're not showing signs of hypoglycemia, you really don't have anything to worry about. You have to just wait until their body adjusts. And I would say 99% of the time, it's always going to adjust. And I don't think you would have much to worry about there. So some things to look out for if you are having a home birth are like lethargy or poor tone. They're having trouble feeding. They're really cold. They're having trouble breathing. They're having like seizures or shaking, vomiting. Those are the really scary things to look for. And in that case, you could have some stuff on hand if you are doing a home birth. But of course, in the hospital, they're going to have all these things for you. But like a buccal dextrose or donor milk is what we had. So I had a good friend who had just given birth, and pretty recently, and we used her milk. And I would just use a syringe without a needle, of course. And while the baby was latched to me, I would just like drip it into her mouth as well. And that's just to help so that before my milk came in, like she was just getting more nutrition, and that would help with her blood sugar stabilization a little bit more. And I did that with my second. So now I'll go to my second birth story.
Wait, one sec, really quick question for you. So baby, okay, so just in case anybody doesn't know, and Lily does, Nichols explains this too in her podcast episode, but I just want to say it here, which is that the concern about neonatal hypoglycemia, just in case you don't know what it is that like they're in the womb and there's typically higher blood sugar happening to them at the whole time they're growing. Maybe it's within normal range, but it's probably going to tend to be like a little bit high.
Yes.
And that can be true of diabetes type 1 or gestational.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, okay, now they've had this constant source of sugar coming in from the placenta, and then now they're born, it's cut off, the sugar source is cut off, and their little bodies have a harder time adjusting with their own glucagon cycle and managing their own blood sugar with cortisol spikes and blah, 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 blah. So they can have these scary dips where they're just a little too low. So that's the concern.
Yes. Essentially, like when you cut the cord, you're cutting off all that maternal glucose that the baby has been controlling. And it's been pumping out this insulin to cover mom's blood sugar being a little bit more elevated. And then boom, you cut it, but it's still producing that insulin because it's been in that environment for 9 or 10 months. So, okay. Yeah, being low it's just, you have to wait for the baby to adapt to its new environment. And that typically happens from like 12 to 48 hours. But I would say after 48 hours, like your baby's going to be fine.
You're good. You're good to go.
Yes.
Okay. One more question for you. How many weeks pregnant were you when you went into labor with her?
Okay. Yes. This is actually, so I was 41 weeks and 5 days with my first. And in all of the medical literature surrounding type 1 diabetes and pregnancy, like your risk for stillbirth increases greatly in weeks. Like they won't let you go past 39. They'll rarely let you go past 40 because, again, this like archaic, these studies are just looming over the conventional world. And unfortunately, these are the only things that those doctors are going off of. Like it would be great if more doctors just really looked at this research and they're like, wow, this is totally archaic. Like I can't believe that we're basing this off of studies that were done 40 and 50 years ago. Like this woman in front of me is having better blood sugars and better A1Cs than most women that don't have diabetes. Like you know what I mean? Like if there could just be more of
logic.
Yes.
logic.
Yes. And I feel like if you can't have a home birth or you're not comfortable doing that, you're really going to have to advocate for yourself. the whole time to like really fight for what you want. And I feel like that can be really exhausting for a woman who's pregnant and you're constantly having to advocate for yourself and for what you want for your birth and for your baby. Sometimes, you know, you just like give up, and that's really sad because at the end of the day, they are just like basing this off of fear from those studies that were done so long ago. And I don't want to just like talk smack on all these doctors. I think at the end of the day, like they really don't want anything bad to happen to the mom or to the baby. So they're just doing what they think is best based off of their knowledge.
Exactly.
So if you want to educate them, then maybe you can do that. And that's a way that, you know, you can – and you don't have to like go in with crazy confidence. But I mean, you could just go and show them that you take better care of yourself than a normal person, or you have near normal blood sugars. So why can't you be – why can't you have this birth? Why can't you go to full term? You know, why do you have to be induced? So I think that there's ways that you could sort of do this without offending your doctor. So it's just something to think about. Oh, and then yeah, so with my second, I went a full 40 weeks. She came on
You only went to 40?
Yeah.
Wow, I bet that was nice. Okay, yeah, let's tell us her story.
Okay, so my little girl, I love her so much. It was just another great pregnancy. I could do that professionally. I love being pregnant, so I'm just one of those weird souls. Okay, again, pretty typical second birth story. Like, was super in denial that I was even starting labor. I was like, oh, these are just little contractions. They don't really mean anything. I went to like a pumpkin patch with my husband and my oldest, and I started feeling things. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, I'm just going to text my midwife, but like nothing's going to happen. So I'm just going to text her like, hey, I'm feeling some things, but I'm probably not going to go into labor. So, you know, I'll be in touch if I need to be. And then when we got home, because I was like still feeling the contractions, I guess. But Curtis is like, you should call your mom so she can sleep with Carmen tonight in case, you know, you go into full-blown labor. And I was like, okay, good idea. So I called my mom so she could sleep with my oldest daughter. So basically so my oldest daughter wouldn't come into bed with us, which she does every night. And so I remember like reading the goodnight, like putting my daughter to bed, reading her stories. And I was like, like going through contractions while I'm like reading her goodnight books, and I come out, and then my mom's there, and I'm like, oh, thank God. Okay, I'm gonna try and get some sleep. It's like 10 or 11. I'm like, I'm gonna go to bed. It's you know, I need to just rest because I'm not even in labor yet. So I put like an eye mask on, I put earplugs in, and I was like, peace, like don't bother me. I'm gonna try and sleep for a little bit. There was no shot I was going to be able to sleep, and I did not sleep at all. Okay. And Curtis, it just got more and more intense. And Curtis was like, should I call the midwife? Should I call it to him? I'm like, no, I'm not in labor. This isn't happening. I just like kept being like, I'm not in labor. This is not happening. I got on the bounce ball. I was listening to like Christian hypnobirthing, which was really nice. But I was just used to that first birth where it was just going to go on forever, and this wasn't actually happening as quick as it was. And by the time I was like on the toilet and like, bleh, like Curtis was like, okay, I'm going to call the midwife. And she's like, Curtis, Gina's literally pushing the baby out right now. And so I was pushing, actively pushing. And the doula lives closer than the midwife, and the doula made it, but the head was already out. So I was in my shower, baby's head was already out, just, you know, making it work. We were FaceTiming my midwife, so, you know, just having a little chat with her while I was giving birth without her. And baby came. Oh, sorry, I get my blood sugars. So my blood sugars were, I think they got up to around 150, something like that. In between the pushes, I just took some insulin. It was fine. What was interesting about that is her blood sugar was actually low. Like it was low on the meter, but she didn't have any signs or symptoms. So my midwife wasn't really concerned about that. And she was talking with Dr. Stu on the phone, and he was like, well, does the baby have any symptoms? And Lindsay was like, no, she's fine. She's feeding. So we just kept like doing repeat testing. And again, like within that 48 hours, her blood sugar completely normalized. But it was kind of scary because some of her blood sugar readings didn't even register because they were so low, but she presented so perfectly. Like she was just eating, she was latching, she was awake, just, you know, normal newborn behavior, nothing to worry about. And, but I would say like actually seeing low or like blood sugars in the 20s it was scary. But she was good. She was good. And I had donor milk for that one as well. So I was just doing the same thing. But yeah, again, after that 48 hours, she was just totally fine. I've never tested her blood sugar since.
Okay. The fact that you had to be like, I can't even imagine. I think about my, at the very end of labor specifically, like with pushing and how you're just off in labor land, like you're not even here mentally. And then you had to look at your monitor and go, shit, and give yourself more units.
Yes.
Dude.
But I'm just so used to it, right? Like, I'm so lucky that I got to be in charge of my type 1 diabetes during my labor process, because often when women who have type 1 diabetes and they go into the conventional setting, they don't even let them use their own pump. Like they'll just like take that off and then hook them up to an IV of glucose and insulin. And so the hospital, who has no idea how to care for your diabetes, is taking care of your diabetes while you're in labor. And I would just feel so unsettled about that. Like no one knows your diabetes better than you. So I just felt, you know, yeah, really blessed that I got to be able to do that. And yeah, that I was coherent enough to
do it.
Action, like, and like calculate in my head, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't, but I can imagine that it would be really hard. Like, I just think that that's very amazing and impressive.
Thank you.
That no one, yeah, seriously. And that no one who hasn't had to do that could have any possible understanding of the amount of like just dealing with a contraction and like breathing and looking around and being like, okay. And then like looking at this thing and trying to make decisions with your brain that's halfway off this planet,
yeah.
You know, so that you can keep it perfectly. I don't know. I just think it's very cool. And it speaks a lot to like the type of person you are, the type of mother you are, that like how you want the best for yourself and your kids and how you don't want it to affect them negatively, even just for like an hour or a couple hours. Okay. Two questions for you. One, what time was she born? You said that like around 11, you would try to go to sleep. So what time was she born?
She was born at 4 a.m.
Okay, so like it was just a full on for those couple hours. And then did you have any complications with breastfeeding and blood sugar management? Or like did you find that you had to eat more?
Yeah,
like, you know, what was your breastfeeding? Yeah.
Yeah, this is interesting. With my first, I don't remember having like crazy hypoglycemia after I gave birth. And with breastfeeding, with my second, I noticed it was very intense. So as soon as you give birth, as soon as you birth out that placenta, all those hormones that have been affecting your blood sugars are gone. They are out of your body, and you need to set your pump settings or however you manage your diabetes back to pre-pregnancy level, pre-pregnancy dosages. So even me setting it back to the little amount of insulin I was taking before I was pregnant, I needed to decrease that greatly too. So I was like barely taking any insulin and I was still going low. It was actually the hardest blood sugar management I can remember having, with such crazy lows after I gave birth to my second child. Like I had one of the scariest hypoglycemia episodes I've ever had. So I've never like been taken away or had to do glucagon or anything like that, or like taken away to the hospital or anything for an emergency situation with low blood sugar. But there was one night where I remember the baby was sleeping next to me. And when you've had longstanding diabetes, sometimes when the alarms go off, they're like in your dreams, the alarm is like part of your dream. So I wasn't waking up because it was in my dream, but it was actually really happening. Anyways, when I woke up, I realized like, oh, I'm really low and I actually can't move my arms. Like I was so low that I couldn't move. And I like finally got the strength to just reach to my, after minutes, it felt like minutes, to reach to my nightstand and like grab my glucose tabs and just like shove everything I could into my mouth. But that was like the craziest low I've ever had. And I don't know if I attribute that to just breastfeeding. I think it's just like, I was taking so much insulin and my body just like, it had just been such a crazy adjustment from taking so much insulin to taking barely any insulin. Like I would eat full meals and not take any insulin for them because I was just going low constantly. So,
wow.
Yeah. So there's just, it's just tricky and it's all around. It's just like a trip. Everything is just a trip. And there's so many hormones that are contributing to everything, the insulin resistance, the insulin sensitivity, and it just never ends.
Yeah. I mean, and then if you're trying to wean, I'm sure that that process, which I know you just weaned. So my youngest two are like the same exact ages as your kids, which is so cool.
Yeah.
And so you just weaned your baby like right when I weaned Sunday. And I'm wondering, maybe because it's slower, actually. Did you notice changes in the blood sugar happening as you weaned?
No, I feel like I didn't have any, like my blood sugars weren't affected by breastfeeding after a couple
later
months.
On. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. This is so, Gina, do you have anything else that you would like to share about any of this, really?
Well, I would say that in the hospital setting, they're going to whisk babies away from women that aren't even type 1 diabetic when they test the baby's blood sugar for whatever reason, if they feel the need to test the baby's blood sugar. I've had friends who have had their baby taken away with blood sugars in the 70s. So it really depends on the hospital and the birth team, what they consider to be a low blood sugar, because there isn't a consensus on like what the actual low level is around the world. Like there isn't a common, I would say the one that keeps coming up the most that people refer to is like less than 40. But again, I had babies that had lower than that and they were okay because they didn't have any of the symptoms. So it's just tricky when you're trying to advocate for yourself in a hospital setting, because there is no, there's no like agreement on that low number. So that can be tricky, but just know the signs to look for. And maybe you can talk about that with the nurses that are helping you, because you don't want your baby taken away from you. It's so important, like for its blood sugar regulation to be on you, to be feeding from you, for you to be getting your milk. So yeah.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a good idea, like you said, to either have some breast milk on hand from a donor, or you could also harvest colostrum to be able to give your baby if this is something in your picture that you think that might happen. Full milk is going to have more sugar in it than colostrum. So if we are really concerned, I think that that would probably be the better choice, but it can still be helpful with colostrum, of course. And this is just such an inspiring story for people who are wanting to do things differently. And I think the main point is that if you are a type 1 diabetic or somebody diagnosed with gestational diabetes who then really works hard to manage it properly in either setting, if your A1Cs, which is like the long-standing, it's like a 3-month average of your blood sugar reading, you want it to be under like 5.5 or so. If your A1Cs and your just sort of daily finger pricks or however you test your blood glucose are looking good and they're looking in the normal healthy range outside of knowing that there is this diagnosis of diabetes, then really the physiology of the pregnancy and the birth is going to be damn near exactly the same.
Yeah.
Because there's not going to be other things that are happening unless in that specific person's history, then maybe if they do have some of that long-standing organ damage, like you mentioned with the kidneys and the cardiovascular system, there could be some different things that are happening on. But in just like the general main idea though, is that if we're keeping the blood sugars under a certain level and we're keeping them set and good, then we don't need to make these hugely drastic changes to the care system of, you know, pulling babies out at 37 weeks if everything is good and fine and dandy. And so to learn to advocate for yourself or choose a different path in the beginning where someone's going to be able to support you, I think probably in the future, it's going to become more and more common that midwives are supported on the back end by some MD so that they can get around, not get around, but you know what I mean? Bust through, I guess, with proper support, some of these restrictive laws that shouldn't be restrictive in general. It should always be case by case of what's happening with this woman in front of me. You know, like Breach, Dr. Stu's main, not main, but like a big thing that he does is teaching Breach workshops to midwives and OBGYNs. And there's still stipulations on that. Like there's still more ideal presentations that the Breach baby can be in where a vaginal birth being attempted is probably like just as, you know, low risk as any other. But there are other ones where we don't necessarily want to do that. And then same thing with twins. So like every woman and baby dyad should be looked at individually when these decisions are being made and say like, what's possible and best or potentially best for this one here in front of me. And so Gina, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with us and all your wisdom and your resources. And so in the show notes, you'll be able to find Dr. Gina's website, Instagram, and then several of the other resources that we mentioned in this episode as well.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being on. Are you pregnant or trying to conceive and looking for reliable, engaging education around how to have a healthy pregnancy and prepare for the future aspects of motherhood to come, like birth, breastfeeding, and postpartum? Well, then look, I've got you. This is exactly the education that you'll receive with my 6-week pregnancy call. You get access to my most comprehensive resource of everything I wish women knew before heading into motherhood. It's simultaneously a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 course, and postpartum planning class all in one. And now it's available not only during our live rounds, where you get tons of one-on-one support from me and a small group of like-minded women, but also in a lessons-only format. The lessons-only version of this course is just that. It's all of the content, but it's without the Q&A calls and without the group chat. This version is available on my website at all times, too. So log on to www.milkmedicine.com/lessons-only to check it out, or you can go to the show notes for the link. I hope that you'll enjoy it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.